Without further ado then, I introduce Dr. Ramling and his talk, Chance, Darwinian Natural Selection, and Why Theology Can't Do Without It.
Well, the scientific issues that pose perhaps the most and greatest problems for Catholic and other Christian theology and pastoral care has been organic evolution. Did life arise naturally from non-life or only by the direct action of God? Once life existed, did species and higher categories of organisms arise, change, and differentiate through natural processes or by special creation? Did their adaptations evolve purely through the Darwinian process of mutation and natural selection or by divinely guided intelligent design? In particular, did human nature, intelligence, and free will come about through Darwinian evolution? Or did God, and does God still, separately create each human soul and infuse it into a material body? Is the concept of a soul, distinct from the body, even tenable nowadays? Today I'll at least touch on all these interrelated issues, but mainly I want to emphasize one thing, namely the question of mechanism. How does evolution work, and what difference does it make theologically? Well, history shows that it makes a huge difference. Along with uniformitarian geology, the idea of evolution itself, or what Darwin called descent with modification, was in the air for several decades before Darwin published on the Origin of Species in 1859. Significantly, though, the theological opposition to these ideas came not necessarily from clerics with professional training in theology, and not mainly from a concern with biblical literalism. It came primarily from pious scientists themselves, especially in Britain, who were the very people studying the mechanisms of nature, but who were anxious above all to preserve a role in nature for purpose, or teleology, and divine providence. Darwin became convinced of the fact of branching evolution by the nested hierarchical pattern of the groups in biological classification. But he was also able to explain how the adaptations of living things to their environments was brought about by the materialistic mechanism of natural selection working on inherited variations. That explanation eventually allowed the idea of evolution itself to prevail in the scientific community. And that was just the next logical step in what had been a long series of demonstrations of naturalistic mechanisms operating in the world, steadily narrowing the space for providential acts by a God of the gaps. That pushing back of the realm of divine wiggle room has continued ever since, as Bob Ulanovitz noted in the previous talk. Still today, a lot of people are only comfortable with the idea of evolution provided that God guided it, or intelligently designed it, or at least helped it over the supposed rough spots, like getting from non-life to life, or from apes to humans. But the notion that starting with the Big Bang, God put evolution on autopilot, or as physicist Brian Swim described it, quote, 13 billion years ago, the universe began as hydrogen. Left entirely to itself, the hydrogen became rose bushes, giraffes, and humans, end quote. Well, that really bothers people. And not only critics, but even advocates of evolution have stumbled. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin got in trouble with his Vatican superiors because his account of evolution called into question the doctrine of original sin. I've argued elsewhere that he might have answered his critics more effectively if he had paid attention to the nuts and bolts of neo-Darwinian mechanisms rather than just focusing on eschatology. So here I want to give some attention to those mechanisms and respond to some of the common concerns. Perhaps the biggest bugaboo in this area is the role of chance. We say that genetic mutations, the raw material of evolution, are random with respect to adaptation. meaning that a mutation is no more likely to occur just because it would be useful to the organism. This is routinely misconstrued to mean that adaptive evolution itself is random, like a Boeing 747 suddenly assembling itself from the contents of a junkyard, as a creationist like to caricature it. But random mutations are only the wrong material, like the clay of a pot. Adaptation is molded by the anti-chance factor of natural selection, which is a result of the physical and biotic environment confronting the newly mutated organism with the brutal necessity of survival. The organisms that happen to have the genes for the best engineering or the best behavioral strategies for survival and reproduction will tend to leave the most offspring in future generations, and these favorable traits will tend gradually to become dominant in the species gene pool. Even if the overall outcome is acknowledged not to be purely the result of chance, because it involved natural selection as well, it's still hard for many people to believe that mere inanimate matter and impersonal natural forces could bring about complex adaptations without supernatural intervention. This misunderestimation of matter on the part of Christians is ironic, since it comes down to us through the heresy of Gnosticism, which has pagan rather than biblical roots. But there it is. Another philosophical thread here that trips people up is the classic dichotomy between chance and necessity, or between chance and physical law, as we heard Dr. Monovitz talk about somewhere. Natural selection does indeed have the qualities of a law. Its action is evidently automatic, inevitable, and analyzable mathematically. And Darwin himself deduced it a priori from the observable facts of surplus reproduction, heritable variation, and finite resources. Presumably, selection would operate on any planet where life existed. But this law of natural selection is in no way inconsistent with the operation of chance factors. On the contrary, if there were no processes involved but anti-chance ones, like natural selection and the gene regulation that repairs damage to DNA, evolution would grind to a halt as soon as it ran out of genetic variety to use in adapting to changing environments. Some people turn this into an objection, though, arguing that natural selection can't be creative because all it does is remove what's already there, decreasing genetic diversity. We don't say that a sculptor like Michelangelo lacked creativity in carving his Pietà, for example, just because all he did was knock pieces off of a rock. But rather than resembling stone carving, where pieces are only removed from a block of marble, the evolution of a population's gene pool is more like clay sculpture, where material is constantly added as well as being removed. That new variety is supplied by mutation, random changes to the genetic material. As a Catholic theologian, Sister Elizabeth Johnson, sums it up succinctly, chance is not an alternative to law, but the very means whereby law is created, end quote. For that matter, chance itself is a matter of degree, from radical chance to blind chance, to conditional chance, to propensities, to determinism, and finally on to intentionality, as Dr. Yolanda Vitz just told us. So chance and law are really parts of the same spectrum of contingencies. Moreover, we don't even have to think of natural selection as purely negative, like eliminating the less fit mutants from a species through direct competition. That's called stabilizing selection, maintaining the status quo of a population's adaptation. Yolanovitz claims that Darwinians emphasize only this aspect of evolution, but selection may not even involve head-to-head competition, such as two bull moose with antlers locked in combat, or even a mash race, like the smallest zebra falling prey to the lion, or the peahen choosing the showiest peacock for her mate over less colorful suitors, or the faster-growing tree hogging the sunlight and leaving its slower-growing neighbors in the shade. When a new mutation confers an advantage, or when the environment changes and adaptation has to track it, then we speak of directional selection. Then competition is between the good and the better, and can take more subtle forms, in which the competitors need never come within miles of each other, and the success of one need not always be gained through direct conflict with others. A better camouflaged mouse in one valley will go unnoticed by the hawk who spots a more visible one in the next valley. A hawk with better eyesight and more efficient aerodynamics will bring more food per day to its nestlings. And sometimes this directional selection stumbles into major new possibilities. A secondary function of a feature may come to eclipse in importance the originally primary function. For example, two bones of the old reptilian jaw joint became superfluous for that purpose, but their secondary function, transmitting sound to the inner ear, became the basis of a whole new mammalian hearing apparatus. This kind of serendipitous sideways shift in function of a feature is the normal way real evolutionary breakthroughs occur, and that's when we see mutation and selection at their most creative. But it gets better. The field of process ecology is now expanding this classic understanding of Darwinian evolution by suggesting ways of looking at this thing called chance. As Dr. Jovanovitz has argued, the role of chance in evolution doesn't need to be restricted to genetic mutations of the classic sort. Now, to give Darwin his due, let's remember that he did not have a particular mechanism of inheritance clearly in mind. Inheritance for him was basically a black box. The simple existence of heritable variations was a given for him based on the long experience of animal and plant breeders. And this was all his theory required. What Darwin contributed was the idea of natural selection working on these heritable variations to produce descent with modification. It was only long after Darwin's death, with the rediscovery after 1900 of Mendel's principles of genetics, that a comprehensive neo-Darwinian synthesis of evolutionary theory could be made, which was done in the 1930s and 40s. But Darwin's ignorance of that black box of genetics turned out to be a great stroke of luck, because it rendered his conclusions very robust in the face of a changing understanding how inheritance actually works. Basically, any kind of heritable change, whether single nucleotide substitutions, chromosomal rearrangements, or anything else, will do for Darwinian purposes and serve as grist for the mill of natural selection. What process ecology offers is just that, other richer ways besides damage to DNA in which heritable change can come about and be exposed to selection. But this involves a bit of a paradigm shift in how we imagine life to have started in the first place. And this in turn offers an elegant way around the first of those supposed rough spots in evolution, how we get from non-life to life. The usual idea is that life began with some simple self-replicating molecule, some primitive piece of genetic code, in fact, that came together by accident and was then improved by selection. That view has gene regulation and repair operating almost from the beginning, preserving useful variations from errors in replication. However, an alternative view propounded by the theoretical physicist Freeman Dyson is precisely the opposite, that in the beginning was a complex population, a primordial soup, if you will, composed of a few hundred kinds of non-replicating molecules and characterized by tolerance of chance variations in what was there. After all, in the absence of replication, there could be no erroneous replication. Dyson imagines these molecules as getting confined in droplets and forming protocells, with replication evolving only later. Now, Dyson's right to emphasize the inherent tension between replication and error tolerance, that law and chance dichotomy, once again. And he focuses on the idea of homeostasis, which is the process of maintaining the status quo in a system by means of feedback cycles. The essence of life from the beginning, he says, was homeostasis based on that kind of complicated web of molecular structures. In other words, maybe metabolism and even ecology came before life itself. He also points out that complex homeostatic mechanisms, such as we see in natural ecosystems, free markets, and open societies, are more resilient than simple mechanisms of central control, like planned economies or the selfish genes of Richard Dawkins. And furthermore, he portrays the replicator molecules that evolve later, nucleic acids like RNA and DNA, as an alien parasitic intrusion and the locus of all selfish or competitive behaviors, such as self-reproduction, as opposed to cooperative interactions. Dyson holds that, quote, the history of life is counterpoint music, a two-part invention with two voices, voice of the replicators attempting to impose their selfish purposes upon the whole network, and the voice of homeostasis tending to maximize diversity of structure and flexibility of function, end quote. But I see a problem here. If those first cells as mere error-tolerant tangles of non-replicating molecules, end quote, managed even to survive, that is, maintain their homeostasis long enough to contribute to evolution, then any internal cooperation or feedback among their constituent molecules has to be seen as contributing to their homeostasis and survival. Given the alternatives of homeostasis or dissolution, maintaining the status quo or failing to maintain it, we're already in a realm where natural selection can and must operate. Protocells unsuccessful at homeostasis will soon vanish. Moreover, promoting one's own survival is just as appropriately termed selfish as promoting one's own reproduction. So given just the persistence of those protocells, this implies that natural selection and selfishness of the most primordial sort actually preceded the protocell's accurate reproduction and thus preceded life itself as we customarily define it. In fact, this provides a ready explanation of how the replicators evolved in the first place. They simply allowed more effective preservation of whichever molecular combinations were better at homeostasis. So it seems to me that Dyson's characterization of the replicators as alien parasitic intruders is a bit unfair. They were a natural improvement in the way the protocells did what they had already been doing, namely persist. So summing up to this point, it seems we have primitive metabolism and probably a sloppy, imprecise form of reproduction, along with ecology, cooperation, competition, and natural selection, all of those things already in place before there's even such a thing as a self-replicating molecule or cell that we would traditionally recognize as a living thing. Before the DNA world, or even the RNA world, many so-called biological processes might already have been up and running and formed the milieu in which nucleic acids and cells as we know them evolved. To put this in just a few words, we might even say that life is a process, not a molecule. In fact, Jovanovic traces this pattern all the way back to the generation of matter and antimatter themselves in the Big Bang. The take-home message here, he says, is that the enduring materials we perceive today are actually the endpoints of dynamical configurations of processes, asymmetries, and feedbacks of bygone eons, end quote. Matter, in other words, is just like life itself, a process, not a particle. Well, I find this idea of life, let alone matter, kind of mind-blowing. How could we have biology before life itself? How could the processes that characterize life today have actually preceded life and produced life? But on second thought, isn't this what we should have expected? Evolution is gradual change, one thing insensibly transmuting into another. In this case, inorganic chemistry leading into organic chemistry, which is simply the chemistry of carbon compounds, and organic chemistry leading into true biochemistry. Really, the only novelty here is thinking of organic chemistry in the absence of replicating cells, but having nonetheless an ecology, a metabolism, going on within and among little droplets, perhaps little lipid-walled test tubes, so unthinkable after all. But now we have to look more closely into these pre-biological processes that might have come to life. And here's where I think Ivanovitz's ideas are very helpful in giving more precise form to the rather sketchy concept of Dyson that I just outlined. In chapter 4 of his book, A Third Window, for example, Ivanovitz talks about autocatalytic loops as being the basis of this evolutionary breakthrough. Now, what is this autocatalytic loop of which he speaks? Basically, it's a positive feedback loop, a relationship among two or more entities or processes that mutually interact to egg each other on, so to speak, in whatever it is that they're doing. And of course, it's not an idea that's original with Ivanovitz or Dyson. For example, he quotes as a source a cyberneticist, Gregory Bateson, who uses the term causal circuit for what Ivanovitz calls autocatalytic loop. In principle, says Bateson, a causal circuit will generate a non-random response to a random event, end quote. Now let's stop right here, because that quote caught me up short when I read it. Non-random response to a random event. That has a familiar ring to it. That's an exact description of natural selection, which I described before as an anti-chance or non-random action of the environment on random events, namely mutation. Bateson and Ivanovitz are saying that positive feedback loops, causal circuits, or automatic loops, outer catalytic loops, whatever you want to call them, not only can but will generate Darwinian evolution. Of course, we've long known that Darwinian evolution emerges from a dialogue, so to speak, between the population of organisms and their environment. The organisms propose by randomly mutating, the environment disposes by non-randomly allowing only certain mutations to survive and spread. And the result is that the gene pool of the population changes over time, which is what we call evolution. But now we're hearing it asserted that this business of non-random responses to random events is even more general than just organisms, that it crops up in principle even in these causal circuits or autocatalytic loops, which can be simple systems of simple chemical reactions, or even purely physical systems, such as tornadoes or hurricanes. Ivanovitz defines autocatalysis as a particular form of positive feedback wherein the effect of every consecutive link in the feedback loop is positive, end quote. Each participant in the loop has at least a propensity or strong tendency to facilitate the next member downstream. If you refer back to his handout to the previous talk, you see a simple diagram of this in this figure 1. When process A increases in magnitude, most of the time B will also increase. B in turn tends to accelerate process C, and C tends to have the same effect on A. This setup is growth enhancing by definition. Positive feedback naturally leads to acceleration. Now, if B changes slightly, either to make it more sensitive to A or a stronger catalyst to C, this change will likely receive enhanced stimulus from A, leading to yet more growth or activity. Or if B changes in the opposite direction, it will likely receive diminished support from A. Milanovic argues that in this way, autocatalysis exerts selection pressure upon its own ever-changing constituents. A random mutation, if you will, in B is selected for or against according to the growth-enhancing or growth-diminishing effect of that mutation on the loop as a whole. And this selection arises entirely within the system as a bootstrapping kind of effect, whereas Darwin thought of selection as something entirely external. But autocatalytic feedback, according to Milanovic, broadens our view of selection by bringing it into the workings of the system itself. This selection, in turn, gives autocatalysis what Milanovic calls centripetality. The feedback loop tends to suck into itself more and more of the material and energy that sustain the loop, as he shows in Figure 4 of this handout. So, quote, any autocatalytic cycle becomes the center of a centripetal vortex, pulling as many resources as possible into its domain. Even in the absence of any spatial integument, any skin that encloses it, so to speak, the autocatalytic loop itself defines the locus of this organic trait. That is, centripetality becomes a core element of a system's identity. Unquote. To me, this implies that such an autocatalytic loop is inherently, first of all, a self with its own identity. And secondly, that it already exhibits what I call selfish behavior in the broadest sense, namely self-perpetuation and self-enhancement by acquiring as many resources as possible, sucking them into its centripetal vortex, as you see the little peripheral arrows in this diagram doing. And all this, remember, is present and fully in action before there is even anything we have called life. We're just talking here so far about chemical reactions. People have called me anthropomorphic for using this word selfish. But if we have autocatalytic systems with individual identities sucking up resources from their environment, then selfishness turns out to be an even older and more general phenomenon than life itself. There's one more element here that Milanovic emphasizes. Namely, that systems differ in their histories, which can be partly recorded in their stable configurations. These can be configurations of molecules like DNA, but also stable configurations of processes. History recorded becomes information. In fact, it's the particularities of history that give an individual self its distinctive identity, in contrast to atoms or simple molecules that are indistinguishable from one another. And so we can glimpse how the self of a stable autocatalytic system under selection, both internal and external to itself, could eventually evolve a yet more stable and precisely reproducible way of recording information it has acquired the hard way about what works best in its environment. By evolving molecules such as RNA and DNA, which are records in the form of instruction manuals, the protocells could have done something analogous to what human societies did when they invented writing to record and facilitate what they needed to keep functioning. By the time the protocells did this, I think they had already crossed whatever we might define arbitrarily as the line between non-life and life. So this model offers a gentle, navigable way around that supposedly huge leap from the non-living to the living that poses such a stumbling block in other conceptions, such as naked DNA forming by chance in the absence of any cellular scaffolding to support it. And note that we have gotten here by means of the known chemical concept of autocatalysis without invoking any divine intervention. The next issue we come to is the dichotomy between the ideas of cooperation and competition, and the debate over the roles and relative importance of these in evolution. On the one hand, I, along with other Neo-Darwinians, have stressed the role of competition, as I did in my book with the late Monica Helwig entitled Original Selfishness. For example, on page 50 of that book, I wrote that, quote, the origins of cooperation and apparent altruism seem explainable in terms of selfishness, and selfishness may have been accompanied and facilitated by cooperation right from the beginning, but no one has managed, or so far as I know, even tried, to explain the origins of selfishness itself in terms of altruism, or shown how cooperative units could persist in the absence of self-preserving behavior. Evolution is most plausibly viewed as following the same course as our individual development. We each started out in life totally self-centered and only later learned to work and play well with others. Selfishness would thus appear to be the more primitive and fundamental condition, with altruism, if it arises at all, as its later appearing derivative. This position is backed up by a large body of evidence from animal behavior and genetics, showing that cases of cooperation among organisms are well explained by the mathematical theories of kin selection and reciprocal altruism. Kin selection means cooperating with others or doing things for others in direct proportion to the closeness of your blood relationship to them. I'll do more for my son than I will for my nephew or my third cousin. This is because I share more genes with my closer relatives. So by helping them, I'm helping to preserve more copies of my own genes. Reciprocal altruism just means doing things for others in expectation of a return. I'll scratch your back because you scratched mine yesterday, and you may do so again tomorrow, even if we're not related. It's an economic payoff rather than a genetic one. These simple strategies can explain most, and maybe all, cases of cooperation in non-human species. So altruism among animals, it would seem, is only enlightened self-interest. On the other hand, many writers have opposed this view and wanted cooperation and mutualism to somehow be considered the foundational theme of evolution. As evidence, they cite observations such as symbiosis in general, in particular the origin of organelles of the eukaryotic cell by incorporation of symbiotic bacteria. Some even cite the affinities for each other that are displayed by subatomic particles leading to the synthesis of atoms and molecules, and call that a rudimentary form of mutualism. But Yulanovitz, in his 2009 book, makes an important observation that brings us back to those autocatalytic loops, and in so doing points to a resolution of the disagreement. Quote, it's very difficult to overstate the importance of centripetality. It's a largely neglected but absolutely essential attribute of living systems. Furthermore, centripetality is an agency proper to the loop as a whole. Although the accumulation of resources is accomplished at the compartmental level, the drive to increase such activity is strictly a consequence of the relational structure of the whole. As mentioned in connection with Darwin's theory, a very important but unstated premise of his scenario is that participants strive to capture and accumulate resources. The conventional Darwinian narrative does not mention the origins of this drive. We now see it as the deductive consequence of autocatalytic action. End quote. So Yulanovitz is explicitly asserting here that competition is derivative by comparison with the internal mutualism inherent in autocatalytic loops. Quote, that is, whenever two or more autocatalytic loops draw from the same pool of resources, it is their autocatalytic centripetality that induces competition between them, end quote. And further, quote, one should never lose sight of the fact that the autocatalytic scheme is predicated upon mutual beneficence, or more simply put, upon mutuality. The competition derives from mutuality and not vice versa, represents an important inversion in the ontology of actions. Thus we find Ulanovitz back in 2009 doing what I had previously not observed, namely managing to explain the origins of selfishness in terms of altruism, or at least mutuality. But in doing so, rather than refuting my contention, I think he reconciles our diametrically opposed statements. Bob and I have discussed this back and forth for the last couple of years, and I think we now agree on the following account of the situation. What we have to recognize is that different levels of organization are involved. Ulanovitz is right that competition derives from mutuality, but from mutuality at a lower level. Within any given level, competition is causally prior and can bring forth cooperation, which then in turn can spark competition at a third, still higher level. Cooperation emerges secondarily at each level as an effective strategy for competing. So, for example, the components A, B, and C of an autocatalytic loop, like in figure one, Bob's handout here, form a mutualistic cooperative at level one. Okay? And suppose that D, E, and F form a similar loop. But then in a larger context, level two, the loops A, B, C, and D, E, F compete with each other for the same finite resources. Eventually, however, they may join, perhaps together with G, H, I, and other loops, to form a super loop, still at the same level too. The super loop, in turn, may compete with other super loops at a still higher level of organization, level three, and so on. To take a concrete example, those prokaryotic bacterial cells competing on their own level might also unite symbiotically to form a eukaryotic organism like an amoeba, creating a still higher level. Such eukaryotic cells may then compete as separate organisms until some of them combine to form a multicellular organism of which the eukaryotes are just the constituent cells. Multicellular organisms might then compete among themselves and eventually combine to form a society or superorganism, such as an ant colony, within which competition is suppressed in order to facilitate competition with other colonies, and so on. Another example, a group of people form a cooperative tribe which competes with a neighboring tribe, and those two tribes form an alliance to fight the tribe across the river, and so on up the scale. What we have in this cooperation competition dialectic, in other words, is a chicken and egg problem. Depending on where in the hierarchy of levels of organization we look, we might find that either cooperation or competition is primary, either is derivative. Which one is ultimately ontologically primary? Seems to be a question not for biology, but for chemistry at least, and probably for particle physics, if not metaphysics, because both cooperation and competition were already present and deeply rooted long before the origin of life. Among living things, both cooperation and competition have to be seen as parts of God's very good creation. Now, once cosmic and chemical evolution have produced feedback systems with any degree of self-perpetuation and replication, then Darwinian evolution is off and running. The envelopes of diversity and complexity are bound to be stretched. According to Ulanovitz, autocatalytic mutualism has an inherent direction tending to generate ever higher levels of organization, newly emergent qualities, and true novelty. Selection, even within an autocatalytic cycle, can be truly creative. So, given life, mutation, and natural selection, neo-Darwinian theory predicts a diversification and complexification of that life with no inherent limit. And indeed, we find that complex adaptations of all sorts, from the biochemical to the anatomical and behavioral, have appeared not just once, but over and over again. Similar eyes in a human and an octopus, similar wings in birds, bats, and bugs, similar societies in termites and naked mole rats. It seems like every halfway decent engineering design has been used by evolution, not just once, but multiple times, just as we'd expect from an intelligent engineer. So it's not a surprise that many people down through history have concluded that the complex adaptations of living things are just that, the detailed designs of an intelligent designer. And since about 1984, we have in this country a vocal school of thought known as intelligent design, or IDE, which claims to prove scientifically that Darwinian mutation and selection are inadequate to have produced the diversity of life we see today. Although they avoid religious language and distance themselves from the biblical literalists who espouse special creation, in practice these ID folks adopt many of the same arguments and goals as the creationists. Because they're also intentionally vague about the extent to which they accept evolution itself, ID has a certain attraction to some theists who don't want to deny evolution, but do think they have to leave room for God to do something useful. I'm afraid this even includes folks at the top of the Roman Catholic hierarchy, where there's still interest in some form of ID as an alternative to strict Darwinian naturalism. While special creation is not presently an issue for the Catholic Church, there remains some uneasiness with the well-founded scientific conclusion that natural selection acting on random mutations suffices to explain the evolution of today's organism, including humans with their intellect and free will. The ancient Christian tradition of defining humans as creatures composed of body and soul has forced the question of when or if, in human evolution, as well as in embryological development, an individual soul was infused directly by God into each human body. This putative event is the critical remaining stumbling block in reconciling scientific conclusions about human evolution with Catholic teaching, which infers a direct divine intervention, effectively a form of ID, in the transformation of lower animals into humans. Well, I don't have time in this talk to discuss ID in detail. It's been exhaustively analyzed and refuted in several recent books. I just want to point out the fundamental intellectual flaw that lies at the bottom of it. The overwhelming consensus of philosophers and scientists in relevant fields is that intelligent design is outmoded science at best, just the old God of the gaps argument from design dressed up in modern jargon. This argument is basically a failure of imagination. If I can't imagine right now how something could have evolved through natural selection, then God must have done it. Hence, ID is the opposite of science. When the explaining gets tough, ID gives up and appeals to the supernatural. In contrast, evolutionary biology, like all natural science, keeps looking for natural explanations of natural phenomena and refuses on principle ever to resort to supernatural explanations because these are inherently untestable. This basic principle of scientific procedure is known as methodological naturalism. It's just a rule of procedure without which the search for knowledge would be immediately short-circuited. It's not an assertion that the supernatural doesn't exist. That would be metaphysical naturalism. Certainly there are evolutionists like Richard Dawkins who embrace metaphysical naturalism, but in doing so they're going outside the boundaries of science and entering the domain of metaphysics just as much as the special creationists are. This distinction between methodological and metaphysical naturalism is one that ID advocates and biblical creationists both refuse to make because they see it as a slippery slope to total materialism. But in fact, many philosophers and scientists, including myself, don't find it slippery at all. What we do find is that Darwin's idea of natural selection is impressively good at explaining our data about living things in testable ways. It hasn't let us down yet. This brings us finally to the implications that all this has for theology and pastoral care, and why I say theology can't do without chance and natural selection. Many recent theological advances have been made in the light of the the scientific understanding of life's evolution, which theologian John Hawke rightly views as Darwin's great gift to theology. In the past half century, evolution has become a fruitful source of theological reflection, beginning with the work of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin and continued by a growing number of other writers. This school of thought, called evolutionary theology, deserves to be more widely applied in Catholic and all Christian ministry because it can deepen appreciation for the majesty of God's creation, the power of natural agencies in bringing that creation about, the nature and limits of God's action in the world, and the value that God places on this created world, including ourselves. In fact, evolutionary theology is uniquely suited to be a Christian theology because it is so deeply incarnational. It underlines, like no other theology, the importance of this material creation, of which God thought highly enough to become a physical part of it in the person of Jesus. More specifically, we can draw the following six conclusions from what I've been saying. Number one. Even though living cells have not yet been assembled from simple chemicals in the lab, we can already visualize ways in which this might very well have happened spontaneously in nature. And what I've outlined is certainly not the only possible scenario that's been proposed. So science today is clearly pointing in the direction of demonstrating that life did in fact arise spontaneously out of non-life on this planet and probably on many others, without direct supernatural intervention. Number two, neo-Darwinian theory has proven so effective at explaining the adaptations of living things by mutation and natural selection that science today finds no need for any intelligent design or special creation of species or higher categories of life, including humans. Number three, this applies all the way up to the highest grades of evolution we have achieved, the attainment of human intellect and will, which have traditionally been considered attributes of a separately created immortal soul. With the various aspects of intelligence, including the capacity for rational choice and consciousness itself, increasingly being explained by neuroscience as evolved activities of the physical brain, there no longer seems to be a need to postulate a soul of the traditional sort to account for the observable features of human personalities. Father Wiseman will talk more about this after lunch. As for the unobservable attribute of immortality of the individual personality, that seems to me best explained theologically by the action of God's grace at the point where our material development leaves off, namely at death. Number four. Competition and cooperation have both been part of the dynamic of life from its beginning, or even before. In various circumstances, both can be survival strategies favored by natural selection. On any given organizational level, however, competition tends to lead to cooperation, which in turn leads to more competition between larger entities at a higher level. Therefore, both competition and cooperation must be seen as parts of God's good creation and of the creative evolutionary process itself. Number five, natural selection enforces selfish behavior on all living things. It's the most obvious in competitive interactions, but it's also true in cooperative ones, which almost always are manifestations of enlightened self-interest. While this amoral selfishness is necessary for self-preservation and self-reproduction, it inevitably sets the stage for immoral behavior on the part of moral agents once these have evolved. This original selfishness is what our tradition has called original sin. Number six, all of this together is important for theology, because it gives us something that traditional Christian theology otherwise lacks, a necessary and sufficient explanation of evil. There's no clearer example than this. of why theology can't do without chance and natural selection. The problem of evil and the doctrine of original sin have long been the most intractable of theological problems. Even when Teilhard intuited the solution 65 years ago, it wasn't accepted, precisely, I think, because his evolutionary explanation failed to specify mutation and natural selection as its mechanism. It's not just any old notion of evolution that solves the problem of evil. It's specifically Neo-Darwinian. We no longer take the Garden of Eden as literal history. What replaces, or rather supplements it, is the much grander story, indeed drama, of evolution. This story begins all the way back at the Big Bang, with particles being formed and coming together and breaking apart according to physical laws as well as chance. Complex molecules organize themselves by chance and chemical laws into catalytic systems. Within those systems, natural selection began to favor and preserve certain interactions, and the molecular arrangements that promoted them, while other arrangements broke down. The successful arrangements evolved into the first living cells, and these cells developed new molecules to preserve information that had proven useful for the cell's own survival and replication. Now everything speeded up. Chance mutations, and that information could be acted on further by selection. Most of these mutations were misfortunes, along with all the other kinds of accidents, injuries, and death that we call physical evil. Physical evil. But some of those random breakages and copying mistakes happened to be useful. Life diversified into every available environment and form and way of making a living. The endless creativity of the evolutionary process was now on display. A dialogue between chance and law, between mutations and demands of the environment, with countless solutions to countless problems tried and tested. Sooner or later, something like us was bound to happen. Living things that could see and judge and act on their surroundings and make choices for better or worse. These creatures were necessarily selfish, like all their ancestors. So some of their choices were also selfish and injurious to others. And so moral evil, also came into the world. The point is that all of this is of peace, a coherent whole, a single creative act by a single creator. The astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson points out that the elements, hydrogen, oxygen, and so forth, occur in the human body in much the same proportions as they do in the universe as a whole. If we were made of an isotope of bismuth, he says, you'd have an argument that we're something unique in the cosmos, because that would be a really rare thing to be made of. But we're not. We're made of the commonest. And that gives me a sense of belonging to the universe, a sense of participation, end quote. Furthermore, this creation was very good in its intent and in its overall result, even though it necessarily entailed physical and moral evil. The stuff of the universe is inherently breakable. We are inherently breakable. So brokenness is inseparable from our existence, not just metaphorically, but tangibly. God could not have made a living, growing, material universe in any other way. In fact, some of the breakage was an essential ingredient in the creative process. Without those copying errors we call genetic mutations, that could not have been the selection and evolution that led to us. As the poet William Blake wrote in another context, to be in error and to be cast out is a part of God's design. Likewise, John Milton's Adam was delighted to find that God was able to bring good even out of evil. Well, as you can see, this train of thought leads to far-reaching theological conclusions about the nature of the Creator and the creative process, about evil, theodicy, and original sin, and about what we mean by salvation in Christ. We'll pursue these implications in our next conference this coming fall. But for now, we can start to see why the scientific understanding of life's evolution is valuable for our faith, and why Jack Haught calls it Darwin's great gift of theology. When we look back along that road we've traveled in the evolutionary sciences back to early 19th century Britain, we see a consistent pattern in the interaction of those sciences with religion, specifically their interaction with the idea of divine providence and purpose. As the historian Charles Colston Gillespie described it, quote, "The trouble was not that progressives themselves rejected the idea of purposeful design, but that their opponents instinctively felt that eliminating providential direction would lead in that direction. In the 19th century, orthodox natural theology was more interested in control than in design. They feared that if God's role as an immediate, if occasional, adjuster of the material world was whittled away, he would also be displaced as a governor of its inhabitants." End quote. Over the two centuries since then, that image of a providence demonstrably micromanaged by a controlling designer God has receded. And that's a good thing for our theology. We've gotten more and more used to the idea of a God who allows the world complete autonomy in the operation of natural laws, and yet cares deeply about this world and has definite opinions about our behavior. This would have seemed paradoxical two centuries ago. But by now, most of us have given up the idea that empirical science could prove or disprove the existence of God. That leaves theology free to contemplate all the intriguing things science implies about what God must and must not be like, if there is a God. It's true that a minimalist or metaphysically materialist view of neo-Darwinism can undermine faith, but the broader view laid out here can be the basis, not a proof, but part of the foundation for a more robust theology. Thank you.
If, as you say, Darrell, there could be things like metabolism, cooperation, reproduction, even before life, does that mean that for certain entities, you as a scientist would find it difficult or even impossible to say whether or not a given entity is alive? And if that's not the case, what is the telltale sign that something is living?
Well, the telltale sign, I guess, is, or a telltale sign by some definitions, is that you have to have self-replication, self-reproduction in order to talk about life. And so something like a virus is kind of on the borderline there. It gets reproduced, but it needs another cell to reproduce it. It needs another cell's genetic machinery in order to make copies of the virus. It needs a copying machine outside of itself. And so most people, most scientists would probably say viruses really aren't alive. But yeah, there's been discussion about that for a long time. So there are things on the borderline. And it's probably simplifies life for us today that there are so few things that are right there on the borderline. We'd spend more time arguing about whether this or that thing was really alive or not. But sure, it's a gray zone. If you go back in evolution, if you could see the things back there at the beginning, it would be hard to say, is this alive or isn't it?
Yeah. I was only going to mention it. What, prions?
Cryons, yeah.
I mean, sort of the, even the
Yeah, they're little molecules that have alternate shapes, and they can do us enormous damage. Are they organic? I guess they're organic, but are they alive? Well, probably not, but you have to worry about them anyway. Yeah, right.
I wondered if you've thought about the fact that in the early science, maybe 300 years ago or so, there seemed to be a general acceptance both in scientists and theologians that there was such a thing as so-called spontaneous generation of life, which presumably would be life from non-life. So why would there be a big difficulty now of accepting the kind of explanation that you're postulating?
Yeah, it's interesting in the history of thought to see how the pendulum swings back and forth. And to get away, it's almost a Marxist dialectic, to get away from the errors in one point of view, you've got to negate the whole point of view and go to the opposite extreme, which has its own errors, and then we sort of, we're tacking into the wind, as it were, trying to get to the truth. So we had to reject that primitive form of spontaneous generation, which says that flies are spontaneously generated by rotting meat or something, to get to a more sophisticated version of spontaneous generation. Yeah. So if we have a sense of that history, then we just say, oh, yeah, well, we've kind of been here before, haven't we? We'll keep on homing in on the truth, I hope.
Yeah, maybe.
One of the powerful implications of what your whole paper and Bob's as well, this might still be going on. I mean, this is not a way back when phenomenon. The scientists at the Carnegie Institution of Washington are searching for this process.
On this planet?
In the deep thermal funnels under the sea, where these non-living so-called molecules, lipids, are perhaps still emerging and then reaching sunlight, and other environmental factors are becoming quote-unquote alive.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to rule that possibility out, but I think it needs to be in some relatively isolated system, almost in a natural test tube kind of environment. Because if those molecules are trying to become alive in a space exposed to things that are already alive and are much more sophisticated and efficient, they're going to gobble up those other molecules as resources, and they're never going to get a chance to do it. It's just like the question, could intelligent life spring up again in some other species here on Earth, among the whales or among the apes or something like that? Well, I think not, simply because we wouldn't allow it. We don't want any competition. If you go to the Human Origins Hall down at the Natural History Museum and look at on the wall that depiction of the bush of human evolution, of which we are the sole survivor, and there's nothing closer to us than a chimpanzee living today. But a couple million years ago, there was a whole variety of other hominids that were much closer to us than chimps and gorillas are today, and they're all gone. We're the last man standing. Is that just by accident? Give them kind of a little shove off the back. I think we would not just intelligent life, but life in general is going to be intolerant of rivals for limited resources, which of course is what more and more hail on this planet.